All right, here we are. Welcome back to Bookwave, the book club podcast. I'm your host, Scotsley, joined today by William.
Hey, man.
And Jason.
Hey, glad to be back.
Today is a special day. We've just finished reading The Lord of the Rings, Return of the King. We finished off the entire series, so with that in mind, what are your first thoughts? Let's start with you, Jason.
My thoughts? Well, it was a bit bittersweet finishing this book because I loved it. I was waiting for book six, waiting for Sam and Frodo to work their way up to the crack of doom. And now that it's finished, I'm kind of like, oh, it's all gone now. But, I think this is a book that I would return to at least every 2 years to read this. I'm going to make that commitment. It's a book I could easily jump back into.
Well, if you were waiting for them to get to Mount Doom, that kind of happened in the first two chapters, and then it was over. So there's not really much to say about that anymore.
That was kind of strange, right? Because after they get up to the crack and the ring drops, it was a bit like anticlimactic, right? Because, the ring's destroyed and Sauron is now gone, but that doesn't necessarily equate to, like, evil being washed off the face of the earth. There's still the southern people. There's still some of the orcs that are left that haven't surrendered, so there's still evil going on. But it was that point that I kind of thought that it was more the... correct me if I mispronounce this French word, denouement, the denouement of the story. It's kind of like, after the climax, there's a slow drop off until the conclusion. So that's what I thought of that point of the book.
Will, how many times have you heard that word used?
Well, this is coming from an American, so like he could be saying any of 1,000 French words. I have no idea. He probably doesn't even know how the letters work.
I don't know how to spell denouement, but it's a literary term that I thought
we'll
was
take your word for it.
Okay.
But you threw me off, too. So I guess you felt like it was gonna go downhill after the ring went in the mountain. Did you feel that it went downhill until the end of the story, or were you surprised? Because for me, like, the entire Shire bit that was the bulk of this last book threw me for a loop. I had no idea that was coming, and that was really quite fascinating for me.
Well, yeah, not so much that the story was going to go downhill. I just thought, okay, that's the big thing that they were trying to achieve throughout this whole story, to destroy the ring. So I was just curious how they were going to wrap it up. And there was still, like, I think 4 or 5 chapters after that.
Yeah.
One of those was the scouring of the Shire, which I think is the chapter you were talking about. Yeah. And that one was not in the movie, surprisingly.
Definitely not.
No, and it kind of felt like the whole point of this final book, like the ring in the movies was the ending, right? But this story doesn't end there, and that's not the ending. And it's actually about, Sam and Merry and Pippin getting back and reestablishing their home after returning from war, right? That's, again, we see parallels to the author's life, I guess. But that was completely removed from the movie, and I felt so betrayed reading that chapter and so in love with the chapter. But it was like, how could you not put this in the movie? Like, this is such an important story and experience that, like, I couldn't put it down once I started reading it.
Yeah, as soon as they got to the Shire, I was like, okay, I'm finishing the book right now. It was like a little golden nugget that I had no idea that was in there, so it was a nice little pleasant surprise. I didn't really feel betrayed about it, but I remember the first time I went on Discord and I was like, hey Will, I just finished the book, and you're like, me too, Peter Jackson's a bad man.
Like, how do you not include Sharky? How do you make this movie and not include Sharky?
Yes. And now...
Well, I think they they kind of finalized Saruman's fate in the movie. What was it? In the second movie where... Wormtongue kills him on the tower instead of in the book. Right. He basically slits his dang throat.
Well, after continuing to be with him for, I don't know, perceivably months, and continuing to be enslaved to him and taking over this, the entire Shire. Like,
yeah.
What? They return in the movies and everything's all bright and beautiful and the party tree was never destroyed and all their homes are intact and there's no ugly prisons and everybody doesn't hate their life and they're not living in communist Shire.
Yeah, and it really fits into the war analogy because, like, after they defeated the Germans in World War II, what did they have to deal with afterwards? All of the, you know, smaller countries dealing with communism. Like, that was a real thing. So the Shire was another good analog for, you know, all these, like, communist Slavic countries that popped up in the aftermath of the war, so.
Yeah, there's also other aspects of it that when the Britons returned back to England after World War II, their home had been completely changed, you know, and I think that's what right. Tolkien was trying to portray in this kind of the American capitalization of their home. It's what we see in this book where they're cutting down the trees and they're putting up these shacks and stuff. And what I thought was interesting about that is somewhere in this book, I'm not exactly sure where, but they refer to the lack of creativity of the shadowy evil forces. So like Melkor and Saruman, they can't create something new. They can only mimic and mirror things that have already been created, and they can mock creations. So when they're building these shacks, they kind of described them as, you know, ugly and pitiful looking. And I imagine that, you know, a good person like a hobbit, they would put some pride into their building and make it beautiful. And the exact opposite's happening with these, I guess you could call them evil characters.
Well, it's interesting for so many reasons. I don't even know where to start, but we'll start with the Shire was like this bountiful place that had a really good quality of life. And there was a war going on. And for many years, they didn't really care. It wasn't infecting them. And then Frodo leaves. And while he's gone, it gets more real for them. And it's like you have all of these people that are now coming in and capitalizing on this crisis. And they're the people that didn't go to actively participate in the war, which is this huge existential global crisis, and it impacts a soldier, right? It allows you to make the decisions you need to do when you're at war and to win and to fight a battle, because when things are calm, you don't shoot people. But when you're at home and you're not at war, you're going to have a reaction. And so I think it becomes easier to feel a sense of community in a town all over the world when you have to pitch in and make sure that everybody's getting fed and taken care of because the people that can fight are gone. And so the impression I have from the Second World War, or maybe even the First World War, I don't even really know. I didn't study a lot of 20th century history, but it was that the women went to work, right? And it became this new paradigm shift where everybody was trying to keep their spirits high and morale high and have hope, because the alternative is tragic and depressing and miserable, and you get lost hopelessly hoping for the return of your husband, your brother, your father, whomever it is. And then you have this group of people that see that that's happening and try and take advantage of it and put in a command structure and a system of control to benefit without actually doing the work of pitching in. And then get back to this comfort state where they're not feeling like they're in a crisis because they've got their own power and they're pretending that the way things are, the way things are always going to be, and they're not trying to get out of the crisis, and they stop having that crisis shift in virtues and stop looking at how they can resolve things, and they start looking at how they can capitalize on things. And when you read it in The Lord of the Rings and you reflect on it, it seems very apparent that that's what's happening. But I don't know if it's, I think it's just a reflection of the circumstances almost. It's like a Stanford Prison Project kind of situation. The
Yeah, because like Saruman and his human, I guess enforcers, if you could call them that, like a gang enforcer,
Mob.
they're having, yeah, this mob, they're having the hobbits do all the work, and then they're coming and reaping in all the benefits. And it's one of the motifs that I've noticed in the book where love and selfishness kind of being portrayed as, you know, the opposites they are, whereas love is a unifying force. That's what the Shire had. And then with Saruman and the mob coming in, there's this kind of force of selfishness that, you know, you hobbits do all this work and we're going to collect, you know, a certain percentage of it or all of it. And it's kind of portrayed as this divisional force where it's separating people instead of bringing them together.
Well, and it's like they didn't integrate and they're not a member of the community, but they're pretending now that their work is valid and their work is enforcing the work of the community while simultaneously expecting the community to benefit the growth of this not community that is pretending to be aiding the community because they're building these ramshackle homes and they're putting in more warm bodies, so clearly they exist and they're expanding, but they're not integrating, and so they're destroying it, and they're becoming parasitic, and it's an interesting psychology that would have to affect a group of people to do that.
Right. And I was gonna comment on the fact that, you know, the commies were able to infiltrate the Shire because like the Rangers weren't there anymore. And I can't help but make the parallel that we made in the last episode about like the Rangers that were protecting the Shire being like the police force or the military, and like when they defunded the police, let the commies run in. I mean, Tolkien knew what he was
Yeah.
talking about.
Well, and it's a power vacuum too, right? And then you have a whole bunch of people who
Exactly.
don't have standard procedure, they don't have decades of training, they don't have the ruts of the status quo. As bad as the way things are, if you completely abandon them, you're just lost.
Right. And I suppose in any power vacuum, the people who inevitably take control are those people who are hungry for that power. And Saruman definitely felt, or at least how he's portrayed, he kind of had this sense that he deserved these things. There was like, so when the hobbits and Gandalf, they're traveling back towards the Shire, they actually meet him at Wormtongue on the road. And I think Pippin offers him some pipeweed, and
He gives him the
he kind
pouch.
of, yeah, and he kind of says, oh, I deserve this anyway. Like, that's just how his thought process is. It's kind of tainted by
Well,
that selfishness.
the pipeweed was from the storehouses of Isengard.
Which he already, like, shadily got on his own from the Shire, his own nefarious ways.
But the chain of ownership. I can
Oh,
understand
that's
where he
right.
came to that conclusion. It wasn't just a sporadically impulsive, I deserve everything. It was, I claimed this earlier and you've stolen it from me, ignoring the fact that he stole it in the first place.
Hey, I stole this fair and square. This is mine anyway. And he doesn't even acknowledge the fact that he gave him, like, his pouch, too. Like, that wasn't his to begin with.
What gets me is that, like, Saruman must have at some point said, I'm too far gone to turn over a new leaf. But like
Right.
up until the fall at Isengard, he was on the road of trying to posture as taking over the world and being second in command and being in line with this new ruler. And then the ruler was defeated. And what you see him do next is just this pitiful, miserable, what are you? You're running one town? You were going for the whole world, and now you're taking over the Shire? The majority of the population of Middle Earth didn't even know hobbits existed. And this is who you're going after?
Well, I was thinking maybe it was an element of revenge, because so when they meet him on that road, he must have already have been in the Shire running things prior to that meetup, and he knows that's where the hobbits are from. So I'm thinking that him taking over the Shire was just revenge for the sacking of Isengard.
But it's like, how embarrassing, you know? Like, you were going for the world, and now you're just stuck squandering your potential because you know how to manipulate some people in some tiny little village population of 300. Like, what's the end game? You're going to do this for 40 years? Like, you're going to do this for 100 years? Why? Where is the ladder? How do you move up in your station from this point? Like, just become a good person or quit.
Yeah, that's a good aspect, a good point. I didn't think of, you know, it's kind of a dead end for him. Like, where is he going to go? What ladder?
Like, how does he sleep at night? Like, that's what you achieved, dude? Saruman the multicolored?
Yeah, we never really talked too much about the Technicolor dream coat that he's wearing in this book, right?
Yeah.
So what?
Yeah.
What?
He's not Saruman the white. He's Saruman the many colored. And his robe, if you look at it closely, has all of the colors of the rainbow in it.
Wow. Like,
it only appears white.
Yeah. They couldn't.
Like Joseph.
They couldn't do that in the movie. Like, they didn't have that kind of effect. Like, it's an impossible to visually create description, but.
You know. Like that dress.
Right. Is it.
They could do it now. They'll do it on the Amazon series, and they'll have the Scouring of the Shire.
Maybe.
Did they describe his many-colored coat in the book? Because I must have missed that.
Yeah. Confrontation between Gandalf and Saruman.
Basically with the same description that Will just said. Like, it never describes him as the white wizard. It's like he's multicolored and he's got a weird multicolored coat. And is it just me, or is that like a direct reference to like Joseph's coat from the Bible?
Yeah, I think you're right. And there were some other references or alliterations that I found in the book related to the Bible. For example, the date that the fellowship sets off is December 25th, the supposed birth of Christ. And the date that the ring is destroyed years later is March 25th, the day that Jesus was allegedly crucified. So I think that was like also a direct reference.
Yeah. I'm just curious to know if there's any like direct parallel symbolism behind like why did he choose the multicolored coat? Like, why reference the Bible like that? Or was that on the top of his head? So it was like, let's just make this wizard multicolored to encompass the powers of all the wizards, like going for like mixing too many powers and going for too much power, something like that. I'm not sure he was going for.
In the biblical story, Joseph was kind of a bit of a troublemaker, you know, and he had some like what powers you could describe as wizardly.
He was a prophet, right?
Yeah, he could analyze dreams
or oracle.
And talk with God and that kind of stuff.
Right.
I don't know. I think it's an illusion. I don't think it's a hardcore reference. I think there's some illusionary elements to it. But that's the problem with original ideas, is that if the Bible wrote about every single freaking possibility and you have an original idea because you didn't read or didn't think about the passage that you read in the Bible and how it references it. Like, there's such an impact and prevalence of all of these stories in everything that it's hard to escape, and it's a chicken and an egg sort of situation.
Yeah, that's kind of what Tolkien said. Like, he said that none of his work was allegorical. It was just applicable and comparable kind of idea. But I think there's a little bit of allegory in there if you look hard enough.
I think for me, the takeaway on the multicolored robe is the lack of focus, right? Like, a white wizard is pure. A brown wizard deals with animals and woods. And then a multicolored wizard has his hand in too many pies.
Interesting.
Yeah. That's kind of what I was trying to articulate before.
Yeah.
So if that, were there other like references or alliterations to the Bible insofar as like, were any of the characters, could they be seen as an analog to like Jesus, for example?
Well, like, speaking of allegory, I definitely think Frodo can be at least applicable to Jesus in the way that, like, when Jesus is crucified on, like, the day that's described in this book right here, he takes on all the evil of the world, like, everybody's sin, and he takes it on to himself, and he dies with it, and then he survives. He comes back 3 days later, and then Frodo takes all the evil unto the world, the One Ring, and then casts it into the fires, or somehow gets cast into the fires, and he carries that cross all the way through with him, just like Jesus carried that cross. And I just felt like this is a pretty big Jesus moment right here. And then afterwards they're like, praise him with many praises, and then I'm reading the Psalms and every other word is praise him with many praises. So it's like, yeah, I think there's a bit of a allegory here.
Well, and just like, sorry, go ahead, Will.
Well, you could also compare Aragorn too as like the return of Christ, right? The second coming, the King of Kings. Mm-hmm. That works miracles in the city and rules over all men for a new generation. Like, return of the king. I feel like that story has been written about.
Yeah, but then I think of the story like, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and render unto Christ what is Christ. It's like, well, you have the Christ figure in Frodo and you have the king figure or the Caesar figure in Aragorn. So it's like, one can't exist without the other, and you need perfect balance between the two. You
know what but I mean? Caesar was not the relationship with Christ that Aragorn is with Frodo. No,
definitely not, but
right.
This is a fantasy book. This is a fantasy book, so Tolkien's searching for the ideal. So I think that's one of the things that he was trying to say, that like, here's a passage in the Bible that I think about every once in a while, and I'm going to say that like, maybe there's a balance between the two, and not just like, this line doesn't mean disregard your politicians, and it doesn't mean disregard religion. Like, this guy's been reading Jordan Peterson or something, you know?
No, I'm going to double down. I'm going to say Aragorn was definitely the second coming of Christ, because he didn't show up. He didn't identify as himself until the world needed him most, and he didn't rule by force. He ruled when the people accepted him, and he was well recognized for his deeds and the miracles that he performed. Like, I don't, like, come on. I think that we've got this alternate reality fantasy allegory of both Christ 1.0 and 2.0.
What if they could both be the same figure? So kind of like
the Father and the Son, the
yeah,
Holy Spirit.
Aragorn. I don't know. I guess Gandalf might be the Holy Spirit, but yeah, Aragorn is the Father. Frodo is the Son.
We figured it out. We did it. We figured out Lord of the Rings. We cracked the code. Cracked the Da Vinci Code.
There was one aspect of Frodo that definitely reminds me of Jesus in his regard to not wanting to kill people. So, for example, right. Saruman is, I think, threatening his life there at the end of Scouring of the Shire. And he looks on Saruman with pity and says, you know, don't kill this guy. And there was also a couple of the ruffians that he said, don't kill them unless they're actively fighting. If they've thrown their swords down, let them surrender and live.
Same with Sméagol. Like, he mourns his death. He didn't ever want him to die. Even afterwards, he was like, I wonder if he could have been saved. Maybe we could have been friends. Something like, he's got a heart of solid gold, that little Frodo.
Yeah, and he didn't really ever fully give way into the temptation of the power of the ring, whereas Smeagol or Gollum completely let himself over to that temptation.
Well, at the very end, he did turn around and say, "I'm gonna keep the ring." It took it getting bitten off by a little, like, decrepit hobbit golem. So
that's right. He did want to keep it. There was that glint of selfishness in it.
Yeah, I don't remember that from the movie either. Like, did he have missing fingers, or am I just, like, remembering?
Like, I think he did have a missing finger.
Okay.
What? Proto?
Yeah, did he lose his finger in the movie? Did it get bitten off?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't remember that part. I just remember, like, Smeagol ripping it off of him and then falling down. But it went into detail about, like, him missing a couple of fingers in the book, like, a couple times. I'm like, oof, don't like that.
Apparently, Tolkien wasn't sure how to end this book. Or, I mean, the destruction of the ring isn't at the end, but he wasn't sure how to end that part of the book where, you know, should Gollum get it and fall in, or what if Sam fell in?
Yeah, I know one thing for sure. I don't think he was going to. Like, I think he knew that he wasn't going to end the book with the destruction of the ring. I think he needed to make a point of, like, well, what happens afterwards? But we kind of alluded to that earlier.
Yeah, and that's something that happens in real life. You know, the war is over, but that doesn't necessarily mean everything's just completely fixed. There's a lot of stuff going on after the last battle. And I think Tolkien portrayed that pretty good.
Yeah.
Overall, highly recommend. My first impression when I finally closed the book was, like, so accomplished. I'm very proud to say I've read The Lord of the Rings.
Yeah. Was this your first time reading through it?
Sure.
Yep, me too.
Yeah, I've owned The Lord of the Rings my entire life. Always. And I've read 7 words up until last year.
Yeah, I remember I bought the box set because it was on sale. Like, I was working in, like, my first job after college. And, like, I was, oh, it's on sale, I'll buy it. And I just never got around to it. I finally had an excuse with the book club. I can put down the comic books at night and read a book for once.
Yeah, it's good to have a solid reason to read all of these incredible books.
Yeah.
Probably going to have to take a break before jumping into the Silmarillion, though.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, we need to pick, like a random
light read,
information
short story.
Like, not even like a nonfiction or something. I actually started reading The Coddling of the American Mind by Jonathan Haidt. It's not bad.
I immediately thought maybe we could do Darwin.
That's a little thick. Do we have any other notes for Lord of the Rings? Maybe not even just for this book, but for the whole series, even going back to The Hobbit, because I kind of felt like he told like a similar arc 3 times, like, from, like, Bilbo's journey to get the dragon's gold, and then Frodo's journey to get to Mount Doom, and then another tiny little miniature version in one chapter of The Scouring of the Shire, where it's like the 4 little hobbits formed an entirely new fellowship, a fellowship without Gandalf. And they have to rally the entire town together to defeat the evil that is Sharky. But it was kind of like an almost campy version of it, where it was like another silly children's story to just round out the whole, like, tale of terror that you just witnessed with Sauron and everything. What do you guys feel about that?
Yeah, I see where you're coming from.
Yeah, in both The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, it is this the hero's journey. You have right. these timid, relatively timid hobbits that go into dark places. And yeah,
it's like three different heroes' journeys. It's Bilbo's, then Frodo's, and then it was like Pippin and Merry, or like the Shire's hero's journey as a whole. Like the entire Shire gets to rally and have their own hero's journey.
Yeah, they go into the underworld, the mines of Moria, or the caves, or Mount Doom, and they come out a stronger person than they were before. You know, they were no longer fearful of they were no longer fearful of, you know, dangerous men, because they knew that they too were dangerous. But they had a way of being dangerous that was kind of guided by the principles of love. You know, not seeking revenge, and
yeah, like
well, they return as the completed heroes, right?
Yeah, like Jordan Peterson's yeah. definition of meek: those who have swords and know how to use them, but keep them sheathed.
Like the scouring of the the scouring of the Shire was like DLC after you beat the game.
Exactly, that's a whole other little story, self-contained. It's like a little bonus.
Like, now that I've actually gotten all of the good armor and weapons, I'd like to have a good fight with them.
Yeah, without the overpowered wizard, without the overpowered archer, without the overpowered king warrior, without the overpowered dwarf. Just hobbits, fully stacked with all of their armor. They got their little knives that they got from the Dwights or whatever, the Whites, not the Dwights, the Whites.
Dwight does have a knife.
No, if he did, it'd be stuck in Jello.
Well, no, it's strapped to his chin.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
I think the other arch that's described in all the books is that temptation, resisting temptation, because I think he portrays temptation as really good, as kind of giving in to satisfy your own desires, whereas the opposite of that is resisting temptation to kind of to will into being, like what we see Sam do. He wills into being for the benefit of others. You know, Frodo's like crawling on the ground in Mount Doom, and he literally like picks him up and helps him.
Yeah, it was interesting that they pointed out how much weight Frodo had lost that made it possible for Sam to actually pick him up. And didn't really get that perception in the movies, but it was like, ah, okay, so Sam walked with him and didn't carry the ring until Frodo was light enough for him to carry.
Yeah, I don't think it would have been a good idea to just go, like, walking on it and just, like, you need to lose a lot of weight for these last few scenes, buddy.
Christian Bale would have done it.
Yeah.
I think the theme or motif of hope was also portrayed in all the books, because they're put in these hopeless situations, but they never give into that hopeless kind of, I don't know, a fatigue you get from hopelessness. I think there's one scene where they're in Mount Doom, they're in Mordor, and Sam sees a star shining in the sky, and that's enough glimmer of light just to give him hope to get through. And that might be just a characteristic of the hobbits, that unlike men, they are more resilient in the face of hopelessness.
I don't know. I'm tempted to disagree with you.
Just to be contrarian?
I mean, maybe not all the hobbits, but these main characters, for example, they're described as halflings. They're small. And there's a corollary in the Bible, kind of this story of David and Goliath, where I could see the hobbits there as David, and they're put in this situation where they no other person's going to say they have any hope of winning, but they end up, you know, coming out ahead.
To be fair, it's a David and Goliath story, even for Aragorn too, because he's up against the Dark Lord. It's a pretty mm-hmm. big deal. He's gonna be like a couple heads taller than you if you're just a human, and he's the Dark Lord. And David was a human too. He wasn't a hobbit. He might have been short, but he was still a man.
Yeah, he was like a half. No, I wouldn't call him a half human, but he was a short little guy.
That's borderline racist, Jason.
Wasn't he just a child?
Yes.
I think he was actually just a tiny little piece of asparagus, if I remember the VeggieTales episode correctly.
I see the hobbits as being portrayed as more human than human.
David was a tiny guy. Like, I thought I was being bad trying to talk about Jesus having not touched the New Testament. But we've read the book of David and Goliath and that story. David was a tiny little guy. Well, at least he had a secret cord, man.
But you disagreed with how I portrayed the hobbits.
I don't know if they're more resilient in hopeless situations. I know Frodo was, but that's because he had a bit of took in him, right?
Yeah, they said some of the hobbits stood up to the ruffians and they got immediately thrown in jail.
Yeah, and it also made a note to say that, like, the notable ones were also Tooks themselves, because they were the ones that didn't back down at all. They stuck it out in their own little section of the Shire. They didn't back down at all. They went to war with Sharky and his big men.
And I bet we could probably draw a parallel between the tribes of Israel and say, oh, the Tooks are like the warrior tribe.
Yeah, the Tooks are the Judah tribe, 100%.
There it is. Let's tee that up for you.
Take that, Paul Vanderclay. We're ready to chat about Lord of the Rings now. We have all the answers. We have them all.
Let's wrap it up before we commit any more blasphemy.
The last thing I noted was the description in Mordor, the crack of doom. I want to say that was like a reference to Shakespeare's Macbeth.
It was the cracks, plural, right? The cracks of doom.
The cracks of doom, okay.
Because the crack of doom just sounds like a really cliche insult.
Sounds like a bad porno.
Yeah.
Damn it.
Sorry, what was the question?
There was no question. I was just mentioning, I thought it was a Shakespearean reference.
To Macbeth?
Yeah.
Which part?
Just the description of the cracks of doom.
Okay.
You might be right. Can't help you on that. Maybe you can Google it for us, Will.
Need more context.
Do you... I wanted to say a couple words about, like, the very end where it's, like, it describes Frodo leaving on a boat or whatever. And I remember that part in the movie being, like, very rushed. It was, like, basically the ring goes into the mountain and then it was Frodo on a bed with all of his friends laughing, and it was really scary, and all the lighting was weird. And then I remember him getting on a boat. I'm just like, oh, this is just some, you know, flowery way of saying that he and all of his friends just died. Is that what happened there? Is that what just happened there? But when I read the book, I didn't really get that impression as much.
The elves willingly drop their robes when they're done living by going on the boat to Balinor and dipping off the face of the earth. Like, they are going to the afterlife, and they extended the honor to Bilbo and Frodo, and Gandalf leaves Earth at the same time with them because the Age of Elves are over.
I definitely
It's the
got
Age of Men.
A sense in reading that section of the book where they, the eagles have dropped them off and they're back in Ithilien, I believe. It just kind of read like they were in heaven. I think Sam even asks Gandalf, like, are all the bad things now going to come undone?
I don't know. I guess I'll have to read them again.
Yeah. It was really weird, though. I still don't really know how to interpret it, but I think that helps me out a little bit, Will. It's just like, it's hard
just assume
to...
that Middle Earth is actually a flat Earth belief. So they're just sailing off the Earth to the death, but they know that they'll transcend their form.
But, like, when you look at the maps, it's like, when they go off the boat, there's still, like, stuff over there. Like, this isn't the only continent. Like, there's more stuff if they keep sailing. But it's like, are they sailing off to another land? Or are they sailing off to, like you said, like, heaven or the afterlife?
Well,
the undiscovered country.
In every philosophy and culture that I have been informed of, going west into the sun is a metaphor for death, and the elves go west. This is in native culture, this is in Chinese culture, right? And it's based probably on the sun rising in the east and setting in the west, but it's this allusion to the sun setting on their lives, right?
Right.
I don't know.
No, that makes sense.
In through the east gate, out through the west gate.
Yeah. Every time I get confused, like, which direction does the sun go? I always think of the Red Hot Chili Pepper song. The sun may rise in the east, at least it's settled in a final location.
I just remember.
Yeah, you're probably smarter than I am, that's why.
I was a Boy Scout, that's all.
Fair enough. You know how to survive and stuff. I'm just
like, I know where the sun is.
Okay, thanks.
Is there anything in, like, Norse mythology about going west?
I'm sure there is, but nothing that I can remember offhand.
Because it feels like he's not just pulling strictly from, you know, the Bible. He's pulling from a lot of Norse mythology, and like the tree of life, or the great the world tree that.
Well, the world tree or the tree of life pops up in almost every religion. Like, there's a world tree and a tree of life in like ancient Hebrew stuff too. So, like. Like the idea of the ring being crafted by like dwarves and elves comes straight from Norse mythology. Like, he didn't invent dwarves and elves. Like, these are things have been around for, like, the Celts, the Norse, they all believed in these things. And like, there's a lot of there is one thing that his horse is named, Gandalf's horse is named Shadowfax, and it reminds me of the Norse story of, like, Loki has to, he has, like, an eating contest with a mystery, like, they don't know exactly what he's facing, but it's, like, the giants are facing a challenge against them, so Loki has an eating contest, and he ends up losing. And they have a runner with them, and he has a race, and he ends up losing. And Thor has a wrestling match with, like, an old lady, and he ends up losing that as well. But they find out at the end that the giants played a trick on them, or the frost giants played a trick on them. So actually, Loki had an eating contest against something that no mortal or immortal could defeat, which was a wildfire, because it just consumed the bones and all. And Thor had a wrestling contest with the old lady, but the old lady was actually old age herself. No mortal or immortal can defeat old age. And the runner, who happened to be a mortal that was just traveling with Thor, he was a squire, and he had a race with his own shadow. He pitted him in a race against his own shadow. Like, it doesn't matter how fast you are, mortal or immortal, nobody or no thing can outrun their own shadow if the sun's behind you. So, like, Shadowfax is, like, nothing's faster than a shadow in Norse mythology. So that might have been a little bit of an inspiration for the name of Gandalf's horse.
Okay.
And just tying this back to Genesis 1, there was also the Tree of Life in that story.
Of course, we got to mention Genesis. Thanks, Jason.
Or Yggdrasil. Or Yggdrasil.
Yeah, Yggdrasil from Norse mythology would be the world tree, that its branches reach out into heaven and its roots reach out into the nine worlds or the nine realms, like Midgard, Asgard, you know, the others, Niflheim.
The place that the frost giants are.
Yeah. I used to know all nine of them, but there's just not space enough in my brain for those.
You can get away with just knowing the major three.
Yeah.
There's
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, speaking of the Tree of Life, kind of at the end when Gandalf is going to leave them, he's meeting with Aragorn on top of the mountain, and they find this Tree of Life and they're going to plant it, I think, in the courts of where Denethor used to rule. But there was this quote from Proverbs that I came across, and it says, "Blessed are those who find wisdom. She is a tree of life to those who take hold of her." And I don't know, it's just something about that resonated with me. And that's the last Bible quote I have.
All right. So where does the tree of the knowledge of good and evil come in? Is that the Malorn tree that they take to the Shire?
No, I said 10 minutes ago, let's wrap this up before we commit any more blasphemy. What have you guys been doing for 10 minutes?
Straight blasphemy.
Talking about dwarves and Genesis.
I'm a heathen, okay?
I do not see any reference to the term life on the one wiki to rule them all on the page of the White Tree of Gondor.
Okay. Mm.
What is it? It's just called the White Tree of Gondor?
Yeah.
You made it all up, Jason. I'm not even going to edit this out.
The Tree of Light.
Yeah. I agree with Will. Let's start wrapping this up. But if you're new around here, you should think about checking out our website at bookwave.club. We got a Discord link in the description of this video and podcast area, wherever you're looking at us. Like, comment, subscribe, share with all your friends and family. You should probably read this book and the two before it.
And the one before that. And the one that comes next.
And the one before the one that comes before that. Sounds pretty good too.
Just so everyone's aware, we don't really edit these. This is just a one-off. We hit record from the start and hit stop at the end, and we hope you enjoy it.
We'll be cutting that out, though. That statement. Or equal to mass times acceleration.
May the force be with you.
I won't say it again.
Don't be afraid to walk into dark places.
Poof, poof.
Beautiful.